Here today, we kick things off with our own media roundtable. Here today, Meredith Rutland, new to the panel. She's a reporter with the Florida Times Union. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
Tim Gibbons is here, editor with the Jacksonville Business Journal. Hi, Tim.
Good to be here.
And Fred Matthews, who blogs at The Examiner. Fred, always great to see you. Good morning.
Happy New Year, Melissa.
Happy New Year to you. And we're going to be talking this hour about what we expect in the city of Jacksonville in the year 2014. We want your thoughts about what you'd like to see happen this year, what you think the biggest stories and changes will be. Give us a call, 549-2937. Emails to First Coast Connect at wjct.org. Tweets to at Melissa in Jax. We also want your comments on our Facebook page. Now, will 2014 ever bring a pension deal to the city? Some discouraging news in this morning's Times Union is the head of Jacksonville's Pension Reform Task Force says his goal of putting together a deal to reform the system is, quote, dead in the water. Bill Shy, the chairman of the Retirement Reform Task Force, says an injunction issued Tuesday will prevent him from having the private discussions he wanted to have with the city's police and fire pension fund about changing retirement benefits. So, are you feeling optimistic or pessimistic about the city ever getting its financial house in order this year? We'll go to your calls in just a moment at 549-2937. But Meredith Rutland, as we kick off the new year, this is another setback for the city as it deals with these many hundreds of millions of dollars in liabilities that have to be addressed.
Absolutely, absolutely. And one thing that makes that even more challenging is the recent lawsuit that the Times Union won because of this pension discussions.
Yeah, and let's talk about that. Okay. For those who aren't familiar with what that was all about.
Absolutely, yes. This summer, during various pension discussions, a new pension deal came out, and the results of that deal were a little bit confusing because based on the public meetings that the city had had, these results hadn't come to light. So it came out that there had been some closed-door discussions, and the city was saying that these fell under federal law, and the Times Union did not believe that that was true and that it actually fell under state law, which under Sunshine State law, you must have open, disclosed public meetings with minutes taken, and news media is allowed to show up. And now, because of all of that, a judge has decided that it does fall under state law, so the city cannot have any private meetings. So one representative cannot discuss pension agreements with another representative behind closed doors.
And 549-2937 to join the show. Fred Matthews, the head of the task force, Bill Shy, saying that this will make the deal he was trying to put together dead in the water. Your thoughts?
It's a bit surprising to hear Mr. Shy make such a definitive statement, especially since just this past week the two subcommittees met and supposedly met and had their discussions. And again, this Wednesday morning at 9 o'clock, the full committee meets to discuss what they've discussed. And quite frankly, they were on the cusp, private discussions or not, of bringing back their recommendations for what the outlines of the pension deal should be. I think one can be a bit surprised by that. But it's going to happen. As we look forward in 2014, this deal is going to happen because the city has to make it happen. It would be unfortunate that this group of citizens would back away from it, but it's going to happen. It's just it just means that if they don't do it, it'll be in the hands of the city council, where it'll be public anyway.
That's what I find fascinating about this, of the framing this as a blow to the city, where actually it's a victory for citizens. The idea that these type of negotiations are supposed to be done in public. What fascinates me about the statement that the deal is dead in the water is the administration was able to reach an agreement with its non-public safety unions in totally open negotiations. I sat through innumerable hours of them where they were able to discuss this and have negotiations in public. Is it more difficult? Sure, but it's the public's business.
And Florida's sunshine laws are among the most stringent in the nation. But let's point that out. Most business must be conducted in the sunshine.
But they're stringent, but they're reasonable. And again, this task force is meeting in the public. It has more than a dozen members who sit there and all give their input. It's all about the numbers, which are clearly public. Everybody knows the numbers. They don't change. Sitting right there is John Keane, the head of the pension, the fireman pension fund, along with the fire union president, the new police union president. Everybody is there, and everybody is giving their input. What's the big deal?
The statement that John Keane is not going to tell me in a public meeting what is acceptable and what is not. John Keane will tell me in a public meeting what's acceptable. Yeah.
Tells everybody.
He's not going to take benefits that accept that cuts that affect current workers. Yeah, he has a list of things that are known to be acceptable. So I find that odd.
It's just not new business, and I'm just surprised at this. It'll be interesting to see what they actually discuss this Wednesday morning if they're going to meet.
And if you're just joining us, it's our Friday Media Roundtable here on First Coast Connect, the first one of the new year. Let us know what you think will be the big stories in Jacksonville this year, what you'd like to see happen this year, and weigh in on the biggest headlines of the week. We'll go to your calls in just a moment. The number to join the show, 549-2937. Meredith Rutland, your final thoughts about this pension matter. You've been covering this.
Right. Really, collective bargaining has always been something that had to be public meeting. And really, this just sets a precedent that says other cities and Jacksonville itself can't do business behind closed doors. Public has a right to know what's happening during these meetings.
Well, also making headlines this week, on Tuesday, a federal judge struck down as unconstitutional a state law that required welfare applicants to undergo mandatory drug testing. This is a setback for Governor Rick Scott. He had pushed this, and it sets the stage for a legal battle that could affect similar efforts nationwide. Let us know your reaction to this. Do you agree with this ruling? Florida's law has been ruled unconstitutional. You cannot test welfare applicants for drugs before they receive their benefits. 549-2937. Tim Gibbons, Fred Matthews, other Republican governors around the country have enacted similar statutes. This could set a precedent for challenges around the country now.
This is one of those conservative checklist items that was used and has been used around the country. It's not necessarily new. It's just that in our case, the governor was able to get it done quickly early on and check that off as one of the things he campaigned he would do, and he did it. Regardless of who it would hurt, regardless of the facts of who's on welfare and who's not, who's taking food stamps, who's not, regardless of that, we want it all done. So he did it, and the legislature agreed to it, and it didn't matter whether in some cases politically, it doesn't really matter if it gets overturned by a court or a judge, because guess what? I did what I was supposed to do, blame the courts for not upholding it. The facts don't mean anything here of who it affects or who it doesn't affect. We want this gone, and we want these people checked out because we all know they're on drugs when they're taking welfare.
And that turned out not to be the case. Less than about 2% of the recipients that were tested were tested positive for drugs.
Right.
Tim.
I'm sure the people who really pushed for this I don't know, probably do not remember that figure. not the thing that sticks in their mind of the low percentage of people. What I find interesting when you use the word checklist before, this kind of culture war sort of thing where you have to do this to prove your bona fide sort of thing. And it doesn't matter in the long run. It's not changing anything other than the people who get kicked off welfare because their kid is using drugs and now they have to leave their Section 8 housing through,
Meredith.
Right. And in terms of that 2%, really to put that in perspective, out of about 4,000 people tested, only 100 or so were found to have been on drugs, and most of it was marijuana. So this idea that someone has in their mind that just because you're poor, you're on drugs, that's just the facts don't line up with that at all.
Let's go to your calls and comments for our Friday Media Roundtable right now, 549-2937 to join the show. Brian in St. John's, let's begin with you. Brian, good morning.
Good morning. I'm just calling. I wanted to comment on the drug testing and the being shot down by federal courts. But there were two things about it that really bothered me. One, I agree with the court decision because it basically says you're assuming that if you're in need and you're looking for welfare, you must be on drugs. So that's where I think the Fourth Amendment argument fits in. But the part that just really frustrates me as far as conservatives go, and they're so concerned about wasteful government spending. I know you guys brought up the point that only a very small percentage of people were found to have been doing drugs. The fact of the matter of that was, though, the drug testing, the amount that was spent to do drug testing was far outweighed by what they actually saved by the handful of people they found. And that was the thing. Like, I don't understand conservatives who are so wanting smaller government that they're willing to go ahead and keep spending unnecessarily for a program like this, when economically it's a failure.
That's Brian in St. John's. The facts did bear that out, Fred. It costs more to administer the program than what they ended up saving on the welfare payouts.
Yeah, I mean, when you looked at the numbers, what is it? They spent something like it was basically the folks get $241 a month in terms of benefits, essentially from one of the programs, TANF. But when you chart up the 54,000 or so folks who are on it, versus the, $173,000 that it costs to administer the program. The things don't add up. But guess what? Government is always bad until I want to use it. And that's what we have here.
And if you're just joining us, we want your comments about the top stories of the week here on our first media roundtable of the new year. Also, what are your big goals for the city of Jacksonville in 2014? What would you like to see happen this year in the city? 549-2937. Let's go to Mark on the west side. Hi, Mark. Happy New Year.
Good morning. Happy New Year. I'm hoping that somehow a miracle will occur and Jacksonville will get its mass transportation house in order. I'm happy not to be able to use mass transportation, but I would like to. And I tried a couple months ago just as an experiment, and it's virtually impossible to get from here to there or anywhere. And I'm talking, well-traveled routes.
Yeah.
Without just changing buses and going to the hub and wait. It's an hour-long journey, and you call the JTA for help, and that's usually not successful. And it just bugs me that meanwhile we've still got the Skyway, which we're subsidizing to the tune of $4 million a year, doing virtually nothing. That money could be well better spent on, getting us to where we, from where we live to where we need to go and back again in a reasonable amount of time.
That's Mark on the west side. Mark, thanks. I think that's a perennial hope, what Mark just voiced, that somehow we can get a better public transit system in this city. Tim Gibbons, why are you shaking your head?
The push for a walkable Jacksonville I've been writing about it for more than a decade.
Yes.
And so I can't imagine the people who are really involved in it have to just be utterly frustrated with nothing ever really happening on
that. That's the thing. A lot of talk and no real action.
Yeah.
But it's just hard to do it from the financial end of it and just from the size of Jacksonville. In former lives, I used to commute from the north side all the way to Jacksonville Beach about 5 days a week. That trip is a 50-mile round trip.
Mm.
It would average me 3 hours to get to work.
Wow.
Okay? And just to go from, let's say, Kings Road, in the center of town, so to speak, to the River City Place shopping mall is going to take you an hour to get there and an hour to get back. But guess what? You drive your car, it's only about 10, 15 minutes from that spot.
Mm-hmm.
We haven't been able to overcome the time frame to get from downtown to anywhere. You're averaging 2 hours on a bus. And that's just untenable for most folks who have to do what they need to do. Having said that, there are still a lot of people who are commuting from the beaches to downtown to work using the bus line.
Mm-hmm.
But they have it down to a system. You got that straight freight line. I know a number of lawyers, but the time frame is just untenable for folks who have things to do.
Now, there is bus rapid transit on the horizon coming in, and that hopefully bus rapid transit is basically dedicated bus lanes that
right.
let them, go like the Dickens.
And they are working on that. Yeah.
They are. So that could be a piece of it. But then you have the problem of people not particularly wanting those in their neighborhood because people never like, stuff like that in their neighborhood. So.
And the layout of this city makes it difficult.
Yeah.
It's a big spread out city.
Yeah.
Doesn't help. And if you're just joining the program, it's our first media roundtable of the new year here on First Coast Connect. We're talking about the top stories of the week, and we also want your calls on what you'd like to see happen in the city in 2014. We'll go back to the phones in just a moment on that at 549-2937. Here's a tweet from Daniel. I'd like to see community leaders and businesses become JAC's 2025 partners in 2014 to unite, find commonality, and move JAC's forward. Referencing the JAC's 2025 JCCI visioning effort that began last year and hopefully will bear fruit this year and in the following years. Well, let's talk for a minute about today's front page profile of Rachel Vitti in the Florida Times Union. She is an educator, an activist, and the wife of Duval Superintendent Nicolai Vitti. Rachel is also participating in a campaign called Straight Allies, working to raise awareness about the push to update Jacksonville's human rights ordinance to include the LGBT community. As we look ahead to 2014, Fred Matthews, do you think that that effort will be revived again?
Well, that's why she's coming out, because they want it to be revived again, and apparently having a rather surprising face, a new face added to this, the straight face of this LGBT effort, will in fact revive it. It'll be an interesting thing to see how far she's able to help them take it in 2014. Their stopgap will be the city council, which still has a markedly conservative bent on this issue. And I think when they turned it down last time, it was based on a simple principle that the current human rights ordinance already does this. So that's going to be I think that's going to be the key argument that will have to be overcome if you're talking about making this legislation into an ordinance, is don't we currently have that? Don't we currently have that in ordinance?
But we do not. Go ahead, Tim.
I think the other key argument that has to be overcome is, are you going to keep your seat if you vote one way or the other? The fascinating thing to me about that first fight to expand the human rights ordinance was it galvanized the LGBT community as a political bloc in a way that I don't think Jacksonville has seen before. And that was their kind of first outing, and not successful, but I could see them as a community now having more cohesion, having a political voice that they didn't in the past.
And for those who aren't aware, the Straight Allies campaign is a public service campaign featuring prominent local straight people like Rachel Vitti and many others who are lending their support to this effort, with the idea being, in the piece in the TU, Meredith, she drew a parallel between this effort and the civil rights movement, pointing out that it took the support of Caucasian Americans to push civil rights over the line back in the 60s. The analogy being that it's going to take straight people coming out and lending their voices to get to bring about this change.
Right, absolutely. And really, she's in a great place to be able to do that, because, you know, since her husband is superintendent, she is really in the know with what's going on in the city and what the big issues are, and she really has the ability to make a change if she believes this is something that should be moved forward. And, you know, it really, to have an initiative like this, it's really going to take a large community effort. You can't, you know, just have LGBTQ individuals pushing this. You have to have everyone, really, if it's going to work.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, I'm just curious, to a certain extent, with obviously she's a high-profile face to bring to this fight. On the other hand, the first fight was kind of led by a group of straight people. I mean, you know, John DeLady and Steve Halverson and the entire Civic Council. The business community had a lot of straight voices that came out in favor of this. I am curious if this is, you know, pushing it further in a way.
Let's go to the phones once again to join the roundtable. It's 549-2937. Don on the north side. Hi, Don. Thanks for calling. Good morning, Don. All right, Don, give us a call back. Let's go down to Mandarin. Janet's on the line with the show. Hi, Janet. Good morning.
Hi, Melissa. I have a question regarding our bus transit system, and I agree with the statements that were made that we do need to make a lot of improvements and revamp the system. But my question is there anything about our public transit system that works really well, certain routes, any aspects at all, that we could promote short term so people who could take advantage and are not aware could use those features that may be helpful.
Janet, thanks for the question. Good question.
Well, the morning commutes are the best times to catch the bus. The morning and afternoon commutes, they run essentially. You can catch a morning afternoon commute. For most routes, they'll run anywhere from 15 minutes to every half hour. They're always going to be packed up. The top routes, of course, are on the north side, where most people, where there are less cars available to the folks who have to work across town. But that's the best time to catch the bus, Monday through Friday, between 6 a.m. and 9:30. Mm. You're going to catch a bus just like that. Now, in the middle of the day, that's when it gets sparse. So you're gonna be stuck looking for a bus 45 minutes to an hour waiting for a bus to come. And that's even if you're downtown at the Rosa Parks Hub.
Let's get some tweets on the air. We asked our listeners, what would you like to see happen in the city in 2014? From somewhere in the city on Twitter, we'd like to see more We Love Jax events. We will keep working to keep Jax connected and proactive. From the Five and Dime Theater, we'd like to see more live local theater in 2014. From TEDx of Jacksonville, we're looking forward to bringing more TED learning events to town, starting discussions and sparking change. From Ben, I'm ready to progress in the city and with the hashtags Straight Allies and I Love Jax. Thanks for all the tweets. Let's go to Michael at the beaches. He's on the line this morning. Michael, are things pretty chilly out there this morning at the beach?
Yes, it is. Very cold. Yeah. I just have a general comment regarding that LGBT. I understand that the two of the council members were basically paid off for their votes to switch for the LGBT vote at the last minute. That supposedly all the council people were going to pass that ordinance, and at the last minute they were given favors to decline it.
No proof of that. That was the rumor, but we do need to stress there's no proof of those allegations. But Michael, thanks for bringing that up. Their eyebrows were raised. The vote seemed to be a lock, and then at the last minute, a couple of council members who had indicated they were going to vote for it switched their votes. Tim,
it was a shock to everyone when that happened. The all of the political watchers, you know, kind of had their own score sheets, and there was the expectation that it would pass by, I want to say, one vote, and ended up with two council people shifting their votes to vote against it.
Fred.
It's a very conservative. I think it was Councilman Gaffney, I think, was one of the surprise turns on that. But you're not going to change Councilman Redmond's vote. You're not going to change Councilman Yarbrough's vote. And quite frankly, you probably won't change Mr. Gaffney again, because the blowback from him within his district was not heavy. And that's what we're talking about here. We're talking about a largely conservative council. You can't play it by race, because many of the black council members are as conservative religiously as are their white counterparts on the council. And that's the key here. Do you have actually the hearts and minds of the council people who come from districts who elected them on a conservative basis morally, which is where this is going to fall? And that's going to be the mountain that's going to have to be climbed here. It is probably the last major moral fight that Jacksonville has in 2014. Could be the year that we try it once again.
John on the South Side's on the line. Hi, John. Good morning.
Well, good morning, and thank you for taking my call. You know, going forward for 2014, I just hope we're going to really open up the river downtown. Things are getting stationed at the shipyard site for the South Bank Riverwalk improvements. And let's all remember that the Ram Dock is only open when Ram is open. So what is the public access component, you know, for the South Bank Riverwalk and these other nodes of activity that could be opened up? And I'd love to hear the responses from your panel.
John, thanks for that. Another nice goal for the year. Just getting back to what we were saying, Tim, like transit, it's a goal we've had for a long time.
It is. The river, the great jewel of downtown that seems to be, I don't know, more appreciated than actually accessed. Obviously, a lot of talk about opening up the landing, which would provide access to the river, but that's not going to happen this year, if ever. So it's something long term, I think, is the time frame there.
Absolutely. Thanks, everyone, who called in with your thoughts about the year ahead.